From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Temptations have a new CD. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the only surviving original member of the group, Otis Williams. We'll hear how the group was founded and how they developed their harmonies and dance steps. Also, a talk with Ethan Coen of the filmmaking Coen Brothers. They have a new comedy called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, starring George Clooney. We'll do a mini retrospective of their films, which include Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Fargo, and The Big Lebowski. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Bach Christmas cantatas, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new film Castaway, starring Tom Hanks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect George W. Bush named more people to posts in his administration today. He chose New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman to head the Environmental Protection Agency and former Senator John Ashcroft as Attorney General. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Ashcroft appears to be Bush's most controversial choice yet. He's a religious conservative from Missouri. He lost his bid for re-election last month. As a senator, Ashcroft took strong stands against abortion, and he led the fight against confirming state Supreme Court Justice Ronnie White as a federal judge. That turned into a civil rights battle. Today, civil rights and abortion rights groups started marshaling their forces against Ashcroft. Ralph Neese of People for the American Way said Ashcroft has an abysmal record on civil rights, comparable to that of North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms. By comparison, there's little dissent to the nomination of Christy Whitman to head EPA. As New Jersey governor, she's been a social moderate, but conservatives point out that EPA doesn't deal with social issues. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton pardoned former Representative Dan Rostenkowski today. Rostenkowski was on a list of 59 people who received holiday season pardons. The powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee was sentenced to 17 months in prison back in 1996 after he pleaded guilty to 2 counts of federal mail fraud. He was accused of using taxpayer funds to buy personal gifts and to pay employees who did little or no work. The president also pardoned Archie Schaffer, an employee of Tyson Foods, who was convicted of trying to influence former Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy with gifts. The president also commuted the sentences of 2 women who received long sentences under mandatory drug sentencing laws. National women's groups had appealed for clemency in their cases. Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations in Washington have been difficult, and gaps between the two sides remain wide. Tomorrow, President Clinton will try again to bring the two sides closer to agreement. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Senior negotiators from both sides have been meeting with American mediators at an Air Force base in Washington since Tuesday, trying to narrow differences on the core problems of the conflict. Israeli officials say they have put forward interesting ideas, specifically on the key issue of who controls East Jerusalem. But Palestinian sources say there are still large differences on the Jerusalem question, and they say the two sides are deadlocked on the return of Palestinian refugees to their old homes in Israel. President Clinton met with the two sides earlier this week and has now decided to do so again to see if he can narrow the gaps enough to justify a U.S.-led effort to convene another Mideast peace summit. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow gained 148 points. This is NPR News. A Spanish judge has released Russian media owner Vladimir Guzinski on bail, but ordered him to remain under house arrest. Guzinski is wanted in Russia on fraud charges. He's free on $5.5 million in bail while Spain decides whether to extradite him to face trial. The 48-year-old multimillionaire was arrested last week at his villa in southern Spain. Guzinski denies any wrongdoing and says he's a victim of political persecution because his Media Most company has criticized the Russian government. A French court has cleared a popular bicycle racer of charges that he organized systematic doping in his team. The ruling was based in part on the court's finding that the drug use was widespread. NPR's Sarah Chase reports.
The former manager of the Festina cycling team and the former masseur, who was caught with a medicine chest of illegal performance-enhancing drugs in the back of his car, were both given fines and suspended prison sentences, as were 8 other defendants. The opinion said The facts would have been enough to warrant time in jail, but the court took other factors into account, especially the widespread recourse to doping in professional cycling and the lack of a real fight against it on the part of sporting bodies. In effect, the court found it was almost impossible not to condone doping and stay at the pinnacle of professional cycling. The sensational three-week Festina trial produced a raft of confessions from across the sport. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
Holiday sales are lagging as consumer spending grew by the slowest rate in 6 months. The Commerce Department said today that spending rose only 0.3%. The holiday shopping season got off to a strong start, but big retailers say sales have been declining ever since. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Temptations were one of the most successful soul groups of the 1960s. My Girl, released in 1965, was the first Temptations record that made it to number one on both the R&B and pop charts. The group went on to have many other hits like Since I Lost My Baby, You're My Everything, and Ain't Too Proud to Beg. Otis Williams, the only surviving member of the original group, is still leading a vocal group called The Temptations. They have a new CD. I spoke to Otis Williams in 1988.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May.
Thank you. Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You point out in your group the Temptations were subtler and more romantic than a lot of the other guys, and that there was no sweating or grunting on the stage. So I want to ask you how you think that was reflected in your songs and in your style on stage.
Well, I think that Paul Williams, who was one of the original members, he always believed in us trying to convey selling sex as well as keeping the class. And I wish I could take credit for not sweating, but him and I especially were sweaters. But we always tried to do things in a top-notch fashion. And
well, you say in your book that you always thought about image. Even when you were in high school and you were singing in the halls and singing at dances, you thought about image.
It's very important, you know, because when you're dealing with the public, it's always nice to set a very good impression. And we tried to do that with a very good image, a wholesome image and what have you. So that has always been one of our main criteria for trying to stay that kind of way because it's so important.
The first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was the way you do the things you do.
That's a good one.
And this was written by Smokey Robinson?
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks?
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies. Okay.
You got a smile so bright, you know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight, you know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off the beat. You know you could have been some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do,
the way you do the
all
things
day,
you do, the way you do the things you do,
as pretty as you are. You know you could.
Otis Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. we would always sit around with Smokey. And Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland, would cut it a step higher because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it, but it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
Now, did you have to be above your range also?
No, I didn't do that much leading in the songs that I did sing lead on. It was in the key because I'm more or less a ballad person rather than the driving kind.
We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days, we had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie's steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hit steps and, you know, a lot of little subtle movements. And you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage and say, oh, that's easy. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special because he's not an easy fella to deal with as far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there because, let's say, if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you missed that and had to come back in, you said, oh, my God, how am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, people would stand up and applaud because it was something really unique.
Did you ever lose it on stage?
Oh, yeah. All of us at one time or another.
How would you cover up?
Oh, we'd cover up. But somewhere along the way, after a while, you say, oh, no, I got to get back in. So you would find a way to get back in. It was just something inside you said, you better find a way. So you would find a way, but it would be hard. You would miss a few bars before you got back in step. So we would cover it up. We'd clown a little bit. Oh, I'm right back to the bandstand to do that and then come back up and, okay, I got it. Boop, and fall right in. But you would catch hell getting in for a while.
Otis Williams is my guest, and we're talking about founding and singing with the Temptations. And before we talk more about it, let's listen to another of the Temptations recordings. This is Since I Lost My Baby. You want to say anything about this before we hear it?
This is one of my all-time favorites because the intro reminds me of a movie theme because it's so big, you know, and I really love the intro as well as the song.
And tell us what to listen to for your voice on here.
I am singing second tenor on this here. I'm singing right under Eddie. One of the things about the Temps, we are noted for being able to sing many different parts. Sometimes I sing baritone, second tenor, first tenor, aside from lead and lead. Never bass. That's exclusive to Melvin.
Okay, here we go. Since I Lost My Baby.
Plenty of light. Oh, a new day is dawning, sunny and bright. Oh, but after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby,
since I lost my baby.
Singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying. But fun is a bore and with money I'm poor. Since I lost my baby, since I lost my baby.
I said Temptations. My guest is Otis Williams, the founder and leader of the group. That's one of your many records that crossed over R&B charts and pop charts. Barry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was really into crossing over.
Yes, yes.
So were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it and song structure. But he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
Uh-huh. And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it, like we said, when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and carrying on with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we say, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you
That's
didn't
it.
Want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Barry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Let's talk about some of the problems with Motown and some of the problems within the group. When you signed your first contract with Motown, you were pretty young, in your teens or early 20s, I forget which.
Late teens, early 20s, yes.
One of the problems internally in the group was when David Ruffin was doing a lot of the lead singing, you describe how he had a really big ego and he wanted the group to be David Ruffin and the Temptations. He wanted his own limousine.
Yeah, well, he did have his own limousine, you know, because we at the time, we had two limousines. David had his, then that was a group limousine. Then we had a station wagon, so it would be like a caravan of three when we travel. But there was a time that we had to meet down in Puerto Rico. And we had a meeting because he felt as though by him doing the lead, he should have it David Ruffin in the Temptations. So we all said, no, that couldn't be because Eddie was singing lead, Paul was singing lead, Melvin was doing Old Man River, and my lead wasn't that much, but we just felt as though it should just stay that one word, Temptation. And so, yeah, ego, you know, we all had egos, I guess, with him being in the lead spot, you know, and, you know, being as fantastic as he, you know, is and was at that time, you know, he just felt as though he should have had that kind of, you know, distinction. And we just said no.
And just tell me, we only have a few seconds left. How is it different for you performing on stage now as a mature man as opposed to as a teenager and a young man when you started?
Well, it's not that much difference because you're still entertaining people, except they have grown with us. And, you know, you see a lot of the new generation because when we were coming along in the 60s and those that were following us now, they have kids, so they're bringing their kids to come see us. So it's that kind of difference. But we still get the adrenaline flow from seeing so many happy faces, and sometimes they are crying tears of joy. So it's still that electrifying feeling of performing to people that of the world over. So it's still great 28 years later.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, and you know it. Please don't leave me, girl.
Our interview with Otis Williams was recorded in 1988. He's still leading a vocal group called The Temptations. They have a new CD called Irresistible. Coming up, we remember Pop Staples, who died this week at the age of 85. This is Fresh Air. Pop Staples of the Staple Singers died earlier this week at the age of 85. The Staple Singers started recording gospel music in the 50s. In the 60s, they also performed soul music with lyrics about dignity and self-respect that resonated with the civil rights and black pride movements. Pop Staples sang and played guitar. In 1989, when I spoke with singer Mavis Staples, I asked about her father. Now, your father used to play blues before turning to gospel.
He did, yes. But mostly just around the house or whatever, not actually on stage. Pops was inspired by guys like John Lemon, Blind John Lemon, and Harlan Wolf. So when he first started playing his guitar, that was what he was playing. If you notice, you hear a lot of blues licks in the Staple Singers gospel songs, especially the first things that the first albums that we recorded. Because we had only Pops' guitar. That was the only music we had with us, and maybe a drum beat. But Pops still plays a very bluesy guitar.
It's an electric guitar, too. Is that unusual on the gospel circuit at the time?
Well, it was at that time. In fact, there were no guitars on stage, period.
Was that considered a more devilish instrument?
It certainly was. And Pops had to go to the Bible and let them know. You know, and in fact, I can't quote the exact scripture, Terry, but there is a scripture that it says, we shall rejoice with strings and tambourines. So you have a guitar instrument is a string. And shortly after, you know, when the church people seem to have gotten past it, shortly afterwards, every gospel a singer on the road brought in a guitar, an electric guitar. Pops's was still different. Oh, he had this tremolo on his, you know, and they would call his a nervous guitar. And so, but like I said, shortly after the Staple Singers came with Pops playing his guitar, every group, the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Nightingales, Mighty Clouds of Joy, any group, gospel group that you could name, hired a guitar player.
Well, why don't we hear something from the Staples family?
Okay.
And you're singing lead on this.
Okay.
This is I'm Leaning. That's the Staples Singers recording of I'm Leaning with Mavis Staples singing lead. Pop Staples died Tuesday at the age of 85. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
All right. Thank you. Now, we are the Staples Singers. We bring you a greeting from the Windy City, Chicago. Yeah. I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day when I saw the birds come rolling, oh, to take my mother away.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com, and from Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Coen brothers have a new film called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, starring George Clooney. Coming up, a Coen brothers retrospective with Ethan Coen. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Bach Christmas cantatas, and Henry Sheehan reviews Castaway, starring Tom Hanks.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're a last-minute shopper still looking for the perfect Christmas gift, Lloyd Schwartz recommends a Bach recording.
Christmas can be the season to be jolly, but it can also be a time for serious contemplation and meditation. The greatest composer of spiritual inquiry is Johann Sebastian Bach, and Bach's deepest investigations into the meaning of Christmas probably lie in the cantatas he wrote for the holy services of that period. Cantatas are relatively short works for individual voices, chorus, and orchestra. Like poems, they explore a theme through a series of interrelated images divided into sections, like stanzas. These images might come from the Bible or from homilies or prayers. Conductor Craig Smith and Emmanuel Music, the orchestra and chorus of Boston's Emmanuel Church, are among the world's leading Bach experts. For the past 30 years, they've been performing complete cycles of Bach's more than 200 sacred cantatas as part of the service each Sunday. One reason the Bach cantatas may be less familiar than other Bach works is that so many performances of them have a kind of monolithic uniformity. What distinguishes Smith's approach at Emmanuel is his deep awareness of their underlying spiritual conflicts. He moves through Bach's shifting moods with extraordinary sensitivity so that each cantata becomes a powerful drama. Four of these Christmas season cantatas are on Emmanuel's first Bach recording. They range from the military splendor of winds and brasses depicting war with the devil to Bach's tender lullabies for the baby Jesus. Here's soprano Jane West and flutist Christopher Krieger with Craig Smith leading the Emmanuel Orchestra.
Thank you.
numerous Emmanuel musicians have gone out into the world and begun major careers, yet many of them still love the sense of community at Emmanuel and return there often. You can hear this intimacy reflected in an exquisite freedom of phrasing. And these musicians don't seem to have lost their idealism, their spiritual center. If they are so convincing about Bach wrestling with spiritual questions, maybe it's because they themselves continue to wrestle with the same questions.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed Craig Smith conducting an album of Bach Christmas cantatas with the orchestra and chorus of Emmanuel Music. Coming up, Ethan Coen of the filmmaking Coen Brothers. This is Fresh Air. The filmmaking team of Joel and Ethan Coen have a new movie comedy called O Brother, Where Art Thou? Most of the Coen brothers' movies reflect their quirky sense of humor and love of film noir. We're going to do a mini retrospective of their films with Ethan Coen. First, let's hear a scene from the new movie. O Brother, Where Art Thou? Is set during the Depression. It tells the story of three petty criminals who escape from a chain gang in search of buried treasure. George Clooney plays Ulysses Everett McGill, the leader of the group. In this scene, Clooney's character meets Big Dan Teague, a one-eyed Bible salesman, played by John Goodman.
That kind of barnyard
language. I believe I've seen you boys around here before. Allow me to introduce myself. Name of Daniel Teague, known in these precincts as Big Dan Teague. All of those who are pressed for time, Big Dan, Toot Court.
How you doing, Big Dan? My name is Ulysses Everett McGill. This is my associate, Delmer O'Donnell. I detect, like me, you're endowed with the gift of gab.
I flatter myself that such is the case. In my line of work, it's plumb necessary. The one thing you don't want is air in the conversation.
Once again, we find ourselves in agreement. What kind of work you do, Big Dan?
Sales, Mr. McGill, sales. And what do I sell? The truth, every blessed word of it, from Genesis on down to Revelations. That's right. The word of God, which, let me tell you, there is damn good money in during these times of woe and want. People are looking for answers, and Big Dan sells the only book that's got them. And what do? You and your tongue-tied friend?
We're adventurers, sir, currently pursuing a certain opportunity, but we're open to others as well.
The Coen brothers co-write their films. Joel is listed as director, my guest Ethan as producer, but they say that in reality, they share all the work. Their crime comedy Fargo won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Their other movies include Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, and The Big Lebowski. Their first film, Blood Simple, was re-released earlier this year. That one's about a betrayed husband who hires a shady character to kill his wife and her boyfriend. That shady character, played by M. Emmett Walsh, delivers the opening monologue.
The world is full of complainers. The fact is, nothing comes with a guarantee. And I don't care if you're the Pope of Rome, President of the United States, or Man of the Year. Something can all go wrong. And go ahead, you know, complain, tell your problems to your neighbor, ask for help. And watch him fly. Now, in Russia, they got it mapped out so that everyone pulls for everyone else. That's the theory, anyway. But what I know about is Texas. And down here, you're on your own.
How do you go about plotting movies like Blood Simple when, you know, when there's the setup and things get complicated?
Yeah, we're really actually incredibly irresponsible about it. We just start writing at the beginning without an idea, without any idea really of how it's going to go. We don't, for instance, outline the script before we start writing it. We just sort of start in with the first scene and see where that leads, which is actually, oddly enough, maybe the reason things get sort of complicated. You end up painting yourself into corners if you don't know where you're going, and you perform weird contortions to get yourself out, which land you in odd places that, well, you certainly, and then hopefully the audience never expected to find you in.
Your brother, I think, had been working on editing cheap horror films before you made Blood Simple together. Are there any particular shots or scenes or stylistic touches that relate to those horror films?
The best of the bunch was a movie by Sam Raimi called The Evil Dead, which had a couple of camera things that we just more or less sort of stole from Sam. One of them was just a really crude homemade method for moving the camera quickly without a camera dolly. But actually, you know, Sam's movie generally being the best of the ones that Joel worked on was something that we learned a lot from.
Is the shot that you're talking about that you borrowed from Sam Raimi that kind of really jumpy, fast? It looks like it would be a Steadicam shot, except it's really jumpy, and it's a really fast kind of, I don't know what to call it. It's not a zoom exactly.
No, it is just a fast track. You're right. Sam called it a shaky cam. It's a sort of homemade steady cam.
Right.
It's and what it is it's just a camera mounted in the middle of a 2x4, which one person grabs at either end and runs like hell with. So it has the, you know, you can sort of clear obstacles, jump over obstacles, skim over or under, whatever. And it's sort of much more fluid than a lockdown track would look, a sort of standard dolly move would look, and more energetic. Largely because the lens is so wide. You have to use a really wide lens or it would become just unbearably bumpy.
Now, I think you used that shot when Frances McDormand is getting strangled in the movie.
Yeah, we did indeed, yeah.
Now, one of your movies, Barton Fink, is about a very pretentious playwright played by John Turturro who wants to write for a new living theater of and about the common man. And his successful plays lead a studio head to bring him out to Hollywood. And I want to play the scene where the studio head, played by Michael Lerner, welcomes Barton Fink to Los Angeles.
My name is Jack Lipnick. I run this stump. You know that. You read the papers. Lou treat me all right? Get everything you need? What the hell's the matter with your face? What the hell's the matter with his face, Lou?
It's not as bad as it looks. It's just a mosquito in my room.
Place okay? Where'd we put him?
I'm at the Earl.
Never heard of it. Let's move him to the Grand or the Wilshire. Hell, he can stay in my place.
Thanks, but I wanted a place that was a little
less... Less Hollywood. Sure, say it. It's not a dirty word. Say whatever the hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. You don't believe me? Take a look at your paycheck at the end of every week. That's what we think of the writer. So what kind of pictures does he like?
Mr. Fink hasn't given a preference, Mr. Lipnick.
So how about it, Bart?
Well, to be honest, I don't go to the pictures much, Mr. Lipnick.
That's okay. That's okay. That's okay. That's just fine. You probably walked in here thinking that was going to be a handicap, thinking that we wanted people who knew something about the media, maybe even thinking there was all kinds of technical mumbo-jumbo to learn. You were dead wrong. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bart? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out, enjoy a song? Is that more than one thing? Okay. The point is, I run this dump, and I don't know the technical mumbo-jumbo. Why do I run it? Because I got horse sense, damn it. Showmanship! And also, and I hope Lou told you this, I am bigger and meaner and louder than any other kike in this town. Did you tell him that, Lou? Coffee?
Ethan Coen, did you ever get a disingenuous introduction like this from a Hollywood studio head?
No, that's certainly not based on life. I don't know. I don't know that kind of character still exists anymore. Hollywood is a little more bland and corporate than that now. It's funny. I hadn't that. And actually seen the movie since we finished it. Hearing it was Michael Lerner's quite funny.
Michael Lerner's great, yeah. And of course, did anyone ever try to convince you that the writer is king?
No. In a word, no. No, nobody's that bald at any rate.
After your first crime film, Blood Simple, the crime films became a lot funnier. And I guess the most successful of your crime films is Fargo, in which Frances McDormand, your sister-in-law, plays Marge Gunderson, the chief of police in Brainerd, Minnesota, and she's investigating a couple of murders. She's also very pregnant. So I want to play a scene in which she's with another cop and she's finding bodies at the crime scene.
Here's the second one. It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah?
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by. There's a high-speed pursuit. Ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what. From his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
You see something down there, Chief?
No, I just think I'm gonna barf.
Jeez. You okay, Margie?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's just morning sickness. Well, that passed.
Yeah?
Yeah, now I'm hungry again.
That's a scene from your award-winning film, Fargo. One of the things I really like about this film is that although the criminals are all actually pretty dumb, Marge, the police chief, who looks like she might be mocked in the movie, is actually a very good cop with a very big heart and very likable. I just really love the way you handle this character in the movie. Tell me about creating Marge.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. A lot of people liked her, and I'm sure that's why the movie did well. I always thought she was the bad guy.
Did you really? Why did you think she was the bad guy?
I don't know. I just related to Steve Buscemi's character more. He seemed like the classic sane person in an insane land. Marge, definitely Fran's character, is sort of embodying the insane land. I kind of found her a little bit alarming, as did Fran. We were all surprised, actually, that people liked her quite as much as they did. But, you know.
Well, tell me what you found alarming about her.
Well, she is definitely, I mean, there are admirable things about her, but she's also definitely sure of herself to an alarming degree. I mean, certainly not given to introspection.
You really thought the Steve Buscemi character is the most sane, and it's Steve Buscemi who is actually hired to kidnap the wife so that people can collect the ransom money and everything gets out of control.
Mm-hmm.
What did you write into the Steve Buscemi character that made him so likable to you and so seemingly sane to you?
Well, I'll tell you, in one respect, he's sort of an audience surrogate in that he's the one person who's not local. Even Peter Stormare, his sidekick, is not of the region, but he's Swedish, so in that sense he's connected to the region. So as a sort of alien in the landscape, he's who even dresses inappropriately for the climate. He's, again, a sort of outsider and audience surrogate in that respect. And, you know, there's just something sort of refreshingly chatty and direct about Steve, his character.
And you've worked with him in several films.
Yeah, several. And we always end up killing his character for some reason.
Does he resent that?
No, he hasn't complained yet. Maybe that's why we continue to do it.
What's your approach to casting been? Do you do the casting yourselves? You've worked with some terrific actors in your movies, you know, Nicolas Cage, W.H. Macy, Frances McDormand, M.M. Walsh, Dan Hedaya, one of his early roles was in Blood Simple, John Turturro, John Goodman.
Yeah, we've been lucky. We've worked with great actors, but it's, you know, anybody who... It's really a buyer's market for that. There are a lot more good actors out there than there are good parts. So if you write something that's interesting to an actor, you'll have good actors to choose from. And, you know, we sort of do, in terms of the casting, it's always been a mix with us of writing parts for specific people that we know or sometimes that we don't know but whose work we know, as was the case with Emmett Walsh in our first movie, and writing parts for whomever, somebody that we don't have any sort of specific actor in mind for as we're writing, which we then subsequently go out and cast.
Well, Ethan Coen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Ethan Coen recorded in 1998. The Coen brothers have a new movie called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, starring George Clooney, John Goodman, and John Turturro. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the film Cast Away. This is Fresh Air. Several movies open this holiday weekend. Film critic Henry Sheehan wants to recommend two, especially Cast Away, starring Tom Hanks.
It's Christmas movie season, and we're all going to the Mega Maxiplex. But will it be worth the wait, the nearly $10 tickets and the sticky floors? If you're going to see Tom Hanks in Cast Away, it certainly will. The latest from Robert Zemeckis turns out to be not only one of the best movies of the year, but an exemplary bit of classic Hollywood filmmaking. The movie is essentially a simple adventure story about a systems engineer played by Hanks who spends the second half of the 1990s marooned on an uncharted and uninhabited island. It's terrifically entertaining, exciting, romantic, and funny. And if you want, that's all it needs to be. Zemeckis belongs to an old school of Hollywood filmmaking that uses plot, acting, and dialogue to tell an engrossing story. But the director then uses the essential plastic elements of cinema to enhance that story. The idea isn't to create some allegory or reduce characters or situations to metaphors, but to expand the material at hand. Or to paraphrase what William Carlos Williams said about poems, movies should not mean, but be. Actions in Castaway resonate. They mean just exactly what they say they mean, but also a little something more, then a little something more on top of that. These echoes are heard clearly in a scene where Hanks's castaway, Chuck Boland, who has spent his professional life tracking packages for Federal Express, scratches out diagrams on a cave wall.
We were en route from Memphis for 11 and a half hours, about 475 miles an hour, so they think that we are right here. But we went out of radio contact, then flew around that storm for about an hour. So that's a distance of, what, 400 miles? 400 miles squared, that's 160 thousand times pi, 3.14. 506, 502,004. That's a search area of 500,000 square miles. It's twice the size of Texas. They may never find us.
What a summation of the modern predicament. The tools of a technologically advanced society measure the exact isolation of the individual. Castaway's main action begins in Moscow, where a cajoling, bossy Boland is trying to whip the local FedEx operation into shape. But there's a brief, mysterious prelude before that. Zemeckis opens his movie with two majestic pans over farmland somewhere in the American Great Plains. These pivoting shots follow a FedEx truck as it drives up to an isolated barn and picks up a package from a sculptress to her husband. We learn in the next few shots he's in Moscow and, unknown to her, living with a mistress. When pans follow some element moving across a landscape, they imply some futility. Because on the one hand, as a panning camera turns on its axis, it is recording movement. But that axis is on a camera stand that is planted solidly in one place. So when we see the panning shot on screen, the movement is displayed as an arc, a part of a circle. We are looking at a journey that, by implication at least, will circle back to its beginning. In what may look like a minor grace note, the film returns to those same planes for its denouement. But if you look carefully, you'll see the endless loop of the circle is broken. The huge, sweeping pans are gone, replaced in part by close-ups. Boland's not running in circles anymore. Castaway turns out to be a deeply optimistic movie. Edith Wharton's classic novel, The House of Mirth, is, as its many fans know, no piece of optimism. It's the story of Lily Bart, a bright, intelligent young woman who is done in by New York high society circa 1905. English director Terence Davies has made a cinematic masterpiece out of this literary one. Gillian Anderson is splendid as Bart, unable to choose between her heart and her head, needing money but wanting love. Eric Stoltz is nearly as good as Lawrence Selden, the one chance Lily has at honest romance. It may not exactly be a piece of holiday cheer, but it's a must-see. Christmas is also the time of star vehicles, and so we have Miss Congeniality, starring and produced by Sandra Bullock, and The Family Man, starring Nicolas Cage. Bullock is the Iron Duchess of whimsy, a performer who doesn't demand the audience's affection so much as pillage it. As an FBI agent who goes undercover as a contestant at a beauty pageant, Bullock gets some laughs with a very good supporting cast, but you may feel mugged afterwards. The Family Man, a reversal on It's a Wonderful Life, has its heart in the right place, but is so clumsily made it barely survives its lengthy, over-explicit setup. These four movies share one trait, protagonists in extremely dire circumstances. But if you go to Castaway or The House of Mirth, you won't be.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas from all of us at Fresh Air.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes around on a special night?
Santa comes around on a special night.
Special night, beard that's white. Must be Santa. Who wears boots and a suit of red?
Santa wears boots and a suit of red.
Who wears a long cap on his head?
Santa wears a long cap on his head.
Cap on head, suit that's red. Special night, beard that's white. Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus. Who's got a big red cherry nose?
Santa's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way, ho, ho, ho?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler, a collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we spend Christmas with the star of the film White Christmas, Rosemary Clooney. We'll listen back with her to recordings that span her career. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tops glisten and shine.